Iran's foreign minister says Tehran's ready to share its know-how and technology with African countries as he pays a visit to Tanzania in eastern Africa. NATO chief says Western alliance must beef up security along its northern flank to counter strategic challenge posed by Russia's Arctic capabilities. And the U.S. Department of Justice releases a redacted version, that is, of an affidavit which was used to justify the FBI raid on Donald Trump's home. Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, Iran's foreign minister says the expansion of all-out ties with African countries is one of Tehran's foreign policy priorities. Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who's on a visit to Africa, made the remarks in a meeting with the Tanzanian president, Samia Suluhu Hassan. Top Iranian diplomat pointed to the country's huge economic capacities in various sectors, such as trade, energy, industry, and technology. He called for the increased presence of Iranian companies and economic agents in Tanzania and the removal of some consular restrictions such as visa requirements. The Tanzanian president also echoed Amir Abdollahian's call for the enhancement of bilateral economic interactions. Amir Abdollahian's tour of Africa has also taken him to Mali and Zanzibar, where he's expressed Iran's readiness to share its advanced medical and scientific know-how with African countries.
Iran and Tanzania have vowed to draw a roadmap for developing bilateral relations in various dimensions. One of them is economy and trade. In this regard, Tanzania's business hub, Dar es Salaam, hosted a joint meeting of economic and trade activists from the two countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, addressed the forum, saying the development of economic relations with African countries, especially Tanzania, is one of the foreign policy priorities of Iran.
The African continent is one of the major economic diplomacy priorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Along this line, Tanzania, as one of the most important countries in the continent, has always had this special status in the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
He also expressed that Iran is prepared to help Tanzania achieve its goals of development and industrialization. He added that both sides are determined to prioritize economic diplomacy. Over 20 Iranian public and private sector companies took part in the forum to show Tehran's serious will for business cooperation with Tanzania.
Africa is a very huge market, and many world powers come to Africa for discovering new opportunities. So I'm here with Iranian delegates to explore the east of Africa, especially Tanzania, to find out the opportunities, especially in telecommunication business, as our company involved in telecom sector.
Business cooperation between Iran and Tanzania is a bilateral opportunity for the two sides. In addition, Africa is a perfect market for Iranian goods like petrochemicals and the food industry products.
Tanzanian economic activists expressed their excitement about the expanding economic ties, saying they had been eagerly waiting for the joint business forum to kick off.
So there is a huge opportunity. Also, having this forum in Tanzania, we have been looking for it for several times. We have been asking for it because we know for all the challenges that we have been observing, this kind of forum can build up that bridge, can bridge up a gap of closing those challenges. So For us, it's a big marriage.
It is a fruitful opportunity for both countries, Iran and Tanzania, to do a cooperation in business, especially in trade, so as we can do exportation and importation of different commodities from two countries. And it is politically stable. We invite more Iranians and other investors to come invest in Tanzania. We have so much opportunity, so guys, you can maximize profit, but also make Iran better and Tanzania better.
Taking Africa's economic potential into account, the Islamic Republic opted to expand relations with African countries. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian's tour can be the launchpad for the Iranian government's long-term plans to expand trade with Africa.
Tehran has attached considerable significance to Africa as it looks to expand its ties with countries beyond West Asia. And Amir Abdullahian's African tour highlights the view that the world is not limited to the West. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
Now moving on to ever-escalating tensions between NATO and Moscow. The Secretary General of the Western Military Alliance says Bloc has to beef up security along its northern flank to counter Russia.
The high north is strategically important for the Euro-Atlantic security. When Finland and Sweden joins NATO, 7 out of 8 Arctic nations will be NATO members. The shortest path to North America for Russian missiles and bombers would be over the North Pole. This makes NORAD's role vital for North America and therefore also for NATO.
And thank you for the warm welcome. Jens Stoltenberg made the remarks at end of a visit to Canada that included a tour of its Arctic defenses. He claimed Russia has reopened hundreds of Soviet-era military sites in the Arctic. The NATO chief added that Moscow uses the region to test new weapon systems. Stoltenberg described Russia's military capabilities in the far north a strategic challenge for NATO. Russia has warned against growing militarization of the Arctic, says Finland and Sweden joining NATO creates a risk of turning the region into a theater of military operations. Concerns are growing as fighting rages around Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Russia accuses Ukrainian forces of shelling the facility, saying it's destroyed U.S.-made howitzer responsible for the attacks.
The artillery position of the Ukrainian armed forces, from which the nuclear power plant was being shelled, was detected to the west of the village of Marganets in the Dnipropetrovsk region. As a result of a direct hit by Russian high-precision munitions, a U.S.-made M777 howitzer was destroyed at that combat position.
Power plant remains near a front line and has repeatedly come under fire in recent weeks. Moscow and Kiev have been blaming one another for the attacks. Zaporizhzhia is Europe's largest nuclear power plant and has been under Russia's control since March. On Thursday, it was disconnected from the Ukrainian grid for a first time in its history. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the connection now has been restored, narrowly avoiding a radiation disaster. Disconnecting from the grid may lead to a catastrophic failure of reactors' cooling systems. Syrian air defenses have intercepted nearly half of the projectiles fired during a recent Israeli attack on northwestern province of Hama. That's according to a senior Russian officer. Officer told Russian media that Israeli jets launched a total of 4 cruise missiles and 16 guided aerial bombs against a research facility in the city of Masyaf on Thursday. He added Syrian troops shot down 2 missiles and 7 guided bombs. Syrian media said 2 civilians were injured in the Israeli attack. Israel frequently carries out missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has time and again condemned such raids as acts of aggression and has lodged official complaints with the UN and other relevant bodies. U.S. forces who are illegally present in Syria have gone on the offensive, striking several targets. In one of the raids, U.S. claimed it targeted suspected Iran-backed or aligned groups without providing proof. Iran says strike targeted popular groups fighting foreign occupation, denying their attachment to Iran. Now it's blasted the, quote, terrorist strike, a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
The United States is increasing its belligerence in Syria by launching airstrikes on the country. On Tuesday, the U.S. has carried out airstrikes on a camp in Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria, claiming the area and the infrastructure there were used by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Iran rejected the allegation as baseless, saying they were a breach of Syria's sovereignty.
And you know, I'm not sure what's going on here, whether they were attacking them because they were afraid that they might be preparing to launch some kind of offensive against American troops in Iraq, or whether they were doing it just to please Israel and to make Israel say, you know, look, even if we go back to the JCPOA, we're still going to be aggressive against Iran.
The U.S. claimed that the attack was in response to a mid-August drone strike on one of its bases in Syria. On Wednesday, the U.S. then launched more strikes in Deir ez-Zor, which were retaliated by rocket attacks against U.S. bases. Several U.S. servicemen were said to be injured in those rocket attacks. The U.S. military's Central Command, which oversees the American forces in the West Asia region, said in a statement that the aerial assault had been aimed at, quote, protecting U.S. forces from attacks. Deir ez-Zor is a strategic province in East Syria. It borders Iraq and contains vast oil fields. The U.S. forces entered that region in 2015 without the consent of the Syrian government.
The United States is occupying Syrian territory illegally and criminally, and the Syrian government has the right to host whatever it forces it wants on its territory. And the United States forces are going to be attacked. I don't know who's going to attack them or whether they'll be attacked, but certainly the Syrian government has the right to attack them and get them out of their country. But the United States doesn't feel it needs to provide proof to people. It presumes that when it says something, people will accept it because they have to.
So Washington has blamed Tehran and what it calls Iran-backed groups in Syria for the attacks on its forces. It stated that August 15th drone strike on the Al-Tanf garrison as a reason for the U.S. attack. The U.S. Military base is mired in controversy. Both Russia and Iran say the U.S. is training and supporting terror groups at this facility. Russia recently targeted these terrorists around the base.
Washington claimed that it wanted to prevent the oil fields from falling into the hands of terrorists, but it has now turned out that the occupying U.S. forces are plundering the country's rich resources. Just recently, Syrian news agency reported that U.S. military has smuggled crude oil from Syria to bases in Iraq. It was reported that a convoy of 122 tankers laden with oil from the energy-rich Jazeera region in Syria's northeastern province of Haska moved through the illegal Mahmoudiya border crossing into neighboring Iraq.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil. And we're working with the Kurds, and we're frankly working with Turkey, and we're working with a lot of countries.
The U.S. is also running Al-Tanf military base in the Syrian province of Homs. The military base lies close to an intersection between the borders of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, and has therefore a strategic importance. It is also the only U.S. military base not located in the areas held by Kurdish militants in the Arab country. It's believed the U.S. is using the base to train and support Daesh terrorists to use them for its own benefits.
They're occupying Syrian territories, they're stealing their oil, they're occupying the most productive agricultural territory, you know, and they have absolutely no right to do this. And they're doing it, and they've said they're doing it, in order to prevent the reconstruction of Syria, in order to keep Syria down economically and socially, and really in order to keep Syria weak and to keep alive the political project of replacing the Syrian government, replacing the Syrian regime, and breaking up the Syrian state, which they've had to put on hold, but they haven't given up.
Like waging attacks against the Syrian army or its allies. The U.S. has aligned itself with Kurdish forces in northern Syria, who took up arms against the Syrian government when the crisis started in the Arab country. But Syria's northern neighbor, Turkey, is not happy with the presence of Kurdish forces on its borders, whom Ankara views as terrorists. Turkey, which is a strong supporter of anti-Syria forces, is now considering a military action in northern Syria. That incursion would further complicate the situation in an already complex environment.
Now, the U.S. Department of Justice has released court papers that justify the unprecedented FBI search of former U.S. President Donald Trump's residence. Unsealed affidavit contains plenty of redactions. Document's conclusion stated that probable cause in fact existed to believe that evidence, contraband, fruits of crime, as they put it, or other items illegally possessed will be found on the premises. Affidavit laid out the basis for a judge authorizing the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida earlier in the month. Now, the raid was part of a criminal probe into potential mishandling of government documents. Agency's boxes containing large amounts of highly classified documents that Trump had not returned back to the government despite multiple requests and a subpoena to do so. Trump has vehemently denounced the raid as a witch hunt. In a social media post, the former president said that the U.S. is now a lawless country and a failing nation. Now, Tehran has organized an exhibition titled The New Era of Iran's Automotive Industry to display its capabilities and plans to boost the automotive industry, which accounts for almost 10% of the country's gross domestic product. Salman Khujuri reports.
Iran has held an automotive exhibition titled The New Era of Iran's Automotive Industry. The event provides an opportunity for auto parts manufacturers and automakers to establish better bonds and meet the needs of the industry and the market through joint cooperation.
We have plans to reform the structure of our automotive industry as well as the relations between auto parts manufacturers and automakers. Moreover, under the plan, the overall promised production target will be achieved in 2025.
According to a report released by the International Organization of Motor Vehicle Manufacturers, OICA, Iran has been ranked the world's 19th biggest automaker in 2021. Based on the OICA data, Iranian automakers produced almost 900,000 vehicles in 2021. That marked a 2% increase compared to 2020.
We have done a lot of work in the automotive industry, but there is still much to do. A car has more than 2,000 parts, and every day 4,000 cars are produced in the country. We do not have any other industries with such managerial, economic, and technological complexities.
The Iranian manufacturers currently produce six different types of vehicles, including passenger cars, Ford WD, trucks, buses, minibuses, and pickup trucks. The sector has directly employed about 500,000 people and many more in related industries. About 75% of local output is passenger cars, while pickups come in the second place with around 15%.
The auto industry is a key driving force in Iran, the operation and prosperity of which keeps almost 60 other industries moving. The industry is only second to its energy sector, accounting for almost 10% of the gross domestic product. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration says it doesn't share the Zionist regime's position on criminalizing six Palestinian NGOs, but also won't criticize the Israeli regime following a military raid on the organizations. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Michael Aria Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Biden administration offers concern but refuses to condemn Israeli regime raids. Here's more. On August 18th, the Zionist regime forces carried out an overnight raid on the offices of seven Palestinian civil society organizations in the occupied West Bank. Armed troops stole documents, damaged property, and welded the office doors shut. Six of the seven targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Dhamir, Defense for Children International, Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, the Bissan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, had been designated as terrorist organizations by the fake regime of Israel in October 2021. The Zionist regime has never provided any public evidence to back up these allegations, and classified documents obtained by Plus 972, Local Call, and The Intercept show that the accusations are dubious. Shortly after the Zionist regime designated the groups as terrorists, they presented the Biden administration with what they claimed to be unequivocal intelligence against Palestinian NGOs. State Department spokesperson of the U.S. Ned Price told reporters at the time, "We received detailed information from Israel. We appreciated the consultation. We are reviewing the information that they provided us." That was 10 months ago, but the Biden administration has still not made a public conclusion about the evidence. At an April 2022 State Department briefing, Price reiterated the same sentiment from October and did not indicate that they were any closer to reaching a verdict. At the briefing, Price was hit with a barrage of questions from the AP's Matt Lee and Al-Quds' Saeed Aragat about the raid. Price expressed concern about the raids and said the administration was awaiting information about situation from its Israeli regime counterparts. The reporters asked why it hadn't released a statement about the evidence from October and why people should expect them to assess any new evidence in a timely manner. Lee told Price that the administration seemed to be in a perpetual state of limbo. "We have not seen anything that has caused us to change our position," Price eventually admitted, which marks the first time that the administration has acknowledged that it doesn't share the Zionist regime's position on this issue. However, Price refused to disagree with the Zionist regime directly, much less accuse them of lying. "So you don't believe the Israelis' information?" asked Lee at one point. "Intelligence information is always information that is the subject of analysis, and different parties can read information differently," responded Price, adding, "they can perceive of threats differently. Our own analysis heretofore of information that was provided last year has not caused us to change our approach to these organizations," unquote. When Price was asked why the administration is simply voicing concern instead of condemning the raids, he curiously referenced October evidence, saying, "I think the fact is that our Israeli partners took an action to designate these organizations as so-called terrorist organizations," said Price, adding, "What we have seen publicly, what they have conveyed privately in recent hours, is that there is an appropriate basis for the actions that they have taken. It will be a matter of urgency for us to review the basis for that information, he claimed. On Twitter, some pointed out that the Biden administration helped facilitate the raids via their inaction in regards to the original intelligence. To be clear, while this is the further U.S. government has come, it still falls very short of where it needs to be, wrote the Palestinian-American political analyst Yusuf Munayyer, adding, their equivocation for months emboldened the Israeli regime to raid these offices today. When will the U.S. finally condemn these actions? How much further does Israel have to go? The Biden administration has had Israel's evidence for almost a year, wrote Foundation for Middle East Peace President Laura Friedman, adding, it clearly knows this evidence is BS. Otherwise, there is zero doubt they would have validated Israel's designated the groups themselves, but knowing the evidence was BS. They appear to have taken the politically and morally cowardly approach of staying silent, an approach that amounts to foreign policy gross negligence and complicity. She continued, make no mistake, this is gun situation. Israel put the gun on the table last October. The Biden administration saw that gun and decided to do nothing to pressure Israel to remove it. Now the Biden administration cannot claim surprise. When Israel aims and fires that gun at the Palestinian human rights defenders. A few Democratic House members also called Biden to act. I am upset by the latest attacks by the Israeli army on Palestinian human rights groups, tweeted Representative Andre Carson, adding, silencing human rights defenders is an attempt to avoid accountability. I reiterate calls from myself and my colleagues that the Biden administration immediately condemn this repression. Also, Representative Betty McCollum said, once again, the IDF has launched a chilling attack on Defense for Children International Palestine, a human rights organization supporting Palestinian children. The Biden administration must condemn these efforts to silence groups advocating for Palestinian human rights and civil society. Last year, McCollum introduced a resolution calling on the U.S. administration to condemn the Zionist regime's authoritarian and anti-democratic repression of the human rights groups.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I am your host, Zainab. We have a roundtable discussion. We listen to what is being said. We deduce the best things out of it. And that's how we come back to reality. Well, today in our studio, we have with us very two special guests. I have Asma on my right hand and brother Mehdi Najafi on my left side. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum. It's good to be here.
Wa alaikum assalam, sister. I'm happy to be here with you.
Same here. Asma, would you like to give a little intro? I know you. But
yes.
Just for audience.
Yes, of course. I am Asma, and I have been studying English literature for so long. I'm a deep dive fan of literature, and it's been a while that I'm being here in radio as well.
Well,
at the service of the audience.
Again, Brother Najafi, we'd want to hear from you a little bit.
I'm Mehdi, and that's all I am. I have studied business finance and management, and I am a student in the seminary of Qom.
Well, Brother Najafi, if I ask you, what are the three things that you need to learn to accept in life? What would be those?
First thing would be that I do not know everything.
Okay.
Second thing is I can be wrong.
All right. You think what's the third thing? I'll ask Asma. What are the three things that you
will die?
Okay. You need to accept that we are going to die.
And the third thing is that we won't die.
We won't die?
Yeah.
Yes, we won't die.
Yeah, we won't die.
And the first thing I have to accept in life is that I have accepted already that one day this life is going to end.
The materialistic life will end.
Yes, of course. Okay. For sure. But that, of course, but again, it is going to be something mournable. And the next thing is going to be accept that life is not always the same as you wish it to be.
Okay.
And also accept your weaknesses.
Accept your weaknesses. So what can I deduce from all that?
You have plenty of things to accept in this life.
You don't accept mistakes, Brother Najafi?
I don't accept mistakes.
Do you?
I try to.
Okay. You said I have to learn to accept I could be wrong.
Yeah, three things that have to be learned.
Okay.
Right? First thing was that I could be wrong.
You could be wrong.
The second thing is I do not know everything.
So does that mean that you always think you're always right? Most
of us tend to do that, to be honest.
Okay.
Like, we don't consciously say that, but we tend to have this self-righteousness within us. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Like, I'm going to put you in the spotlight here. Have you ever had an experience where you're in an argument and you're losing? Like, you know you're wrong and you just carry on arguing for
no
reason.
You know women never lose an argument.
Exactly. That's very true.
Precisely. That's what I'm saying. You are a manifest example of what I said right now. You know, like, I've got one right in front of me. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah.
So realizing you have to accept that sometimes the truth is in front of you.
Yeah. I'm saying that the worst case scenario is that the truth is in front of you. You've actually known that you were wrong.
Yeah.
And you it's just too hard for you to realize and acknowledge that you were wrong. You understand?
Okay.
There's no problem with that. The second thing I was saying is, know that I do not know everything. Al-qawlu ma adri nisful ilm.
Yeah.
You know, like saying that I don't know is half of knowledge, right? You can't learn anything when you think you know everything. You understand?
Of course. Yeah,
it's okay.
It's all right. Yeah, it's okay to not know something, you know? And the third thing is that we won't die. That we have to realize that we don't die.
Yeah.
You know?
So we don't have to be scared of dying here.
Yeah.
Departing our soul.
Okay, departure. Yeah, yeah. Let's call it departure.
Right. Yeah. See?
Leaving for eternal.
She's realized the first point that she could be wrong. You know, that's a good thing.
So I'm a good learner.
We're progressing,
learner.
You know, we're getting somewhere here now.
Nice.
You know what I'm saying?
Fast learner.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have to realize that certain things have to be left behind or have to be not given all the attention, which that attention could be focused somewhere else that helps you grow eternally, right? In that sense.
I'll be continuing this discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We are discussing what are the three things that you need to learn to accept in life.
If I don't die, I know where to plan for.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
If I know that I'm not going to die, I am an infinite being.
Yeah.
I know where to plan for.
But that would be dangerous for some people, though. Because when I think that I won't die, then I would be so brutal.
Yeah, but you don't die. No one dies. That's something
we
have to realize.
Well, we all die. Don't make it philosophical. We all die, but the spirit is not going to die.
Who is we? Define we.
human beings, the body, is going to die.
So you are your body?
No, I'm not my body. My spirit will live on.
Yeah, so you are not dying.
My body is going to die.
Yeah, your body. You know, like your body.
So in this this physical world, we're going to say bye to this physical world and go into another world, which is going to be spiritual.
Which means you're not going to die. You don't die.
We die, but our spirit will keep on living.
Well, that's back to reality.
Yeah, come back to reality.
Come back to reality.
Yes. Listen.
Here, I don't have a difference of opinion with Brother Najafi. We never die. Mm-hmm. I am with him. We just leave this body over here.
That's what I'm saying. Your body. You know, you're saying my body.
Yes.
Means that you are other than your body. You are other than your body. Which means that we do not die.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
I know.
The concept of we does not
die. Come on, I know that. I know that we have a body and we have a spirit. I know that body dies and the spirit would never die. I know that. The process of departure is something very difficult.
Females are so much attached to their bodies. You need to accept this concept that you have to leave this body.
Yeah, certainly. It's
really hard to accept.
Yes, it is. It really is.
It's valuable. Mm-hmm. You know, the body is something valuable. I think a kidney is sold for a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
There's some valuable in a sense.
Trader.
But what I'm saying is when I realized that me, not the body, I am not going to finish, you know, I'm not going to die.
Okay.
That makes my worldview larger, wider, and that makes my focuses, my priorities, is going to switch that completely.
And I think that will make one more thing very easier for you. When any close one leaves from this world, you don't have that much pain.
Anything. You lose your money. You lose a loved one, you know. You don't get something that you really, really, really wanted, right? That's not going to cause you that trauma, you know. You're not going to commit suicide over an iPhone.
That's very difficult.
You know?
Very difficult. What you're talking about is very difficult.
Yeah, but
I have to learn to accept.
Yes, we have to learn.
Yeah, yeah,
that
fair
thing.
Enough. But out of what? Out of a lifetime. That's what we're talking about, right? The question was three things that you want throughout your life, right?
Yeah.
So that's a long period to accept only three things, right?
Yes, yes.
So this out of a lifetime, just take this one thing out of a lifetime. I think a lifetime is enough for us to acknowledge that there's just one thing that I need to accept. You understand? In that sense, it might be difficult in a minute.
True.
In a year, right? But in a lifetime. You know?
I think I need to learn and accept that people don't die for you. I am so much associated in every relation. I'm so, so emotional. And then I am in that emotional trauma.
In short, do not invest on people.
I won't say exactly that, but I have to learn that life moves on and not like everyone stops with you.
So sad.
People move on. Okay, the second thing that I have to accept is that sometimes my husband could be right. When I say, no, I was right, but with the time I realize he was right. So yes, I am. One of the things I have to learn is that
easily, because only sometimes he can be right.
Yes, yes. You can't be right all the
sometimes.
Time. Seriously.
Yes, and sometimes. Some very little time.
Yeah, but rarely. He's rarely right.
It is so hard for females, especially, to accept that. Especially if you're a female. Asma, what do you say about that?
I'm not like that. I accept something which is right, no matter what, even if it's against me. I usually accept it very
easily. That is a massive claim, you know that. That's a massive claim.
Yes, I am like that. I would accept the truth if I could get justified. if they justify me, then I would believe...
Right, so you have to be talked out of your mentality. Someone has to convince you first.
Yes, yes.
Convince
yes.
her. Yeah. Someone has to convince her.
That's the most the hardest thing to do for like two women. Like convincing women is the
hardest
thing.
No, if there's a logic behind it, it's not very difficult. Right. If there is logic, then it's not very difficult.
Well, coming back to the last thing is that I have to accept that time will not come back. There are certain things we put.
That's very true.
We put on like I'll be having some time in life to say sorry to someone. To, you know, to do other things, to do other important tasks. But we have to accept that time is flying.
It reminds me of Hadith Imam Ali alayhi salatu salam. He says, كَمْ مُسَوِّفٍ مِّنَّ الْعَجَلِ حَتَّى هَجَمَ عَلَيْهِمُ الْأَجَلِ. Like, so many people, like, you know, procrastination. He's like, كَمْ مُسَوِّفٍ, like, sofa, I'll do it later.
Yeah.
Whereas they were supposed to be quick and hasty on that. حَتَّى هَجَمَ عَلَيْهِمُ الْأَجَلِ. People tend to procrastinate over things they were supposed to do instantly to the time that they meet their own death.
Exactly. And I have learned a bit little to take care of that after I went to the contemplation of Surah Asr, which swears on the time. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that you all are in loss, human being is in loss. So yes, I had to, the third one was the most important one. I have to accept that time is passing. I don't have enough time to do things tomorrow or the day after or like leave my tasks for tomorrow. Well, we came to the conclusion that in this world, as Brother Najafi put it, like we are going to live forever. That's one of the realities we have to accept.
Mm-hmm.
That would take us out of all the traumas we face. And it's very, very hard to come out of traumas. But one of the things that could really, really help us is accepting that we are going to live forever. That's one. And other thing was that we could be wrong. We could be wrong. And that was one of the common things, I think.
And that we have a limited time within our bodies.
We have limited time. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The source of all power, my need in my darkest hour, my Lord. Your light and love, all I seek, nothing more I'd ever want or need, my Lord.
My Lord.
Protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Rather than going around the world collecting military allies and imposing sanctions on countries that do not wish to align with the United States, China invites partners to collaborate on mutually beneficial bases. We now present you an article written by Dr. George Koo, the founder and former managing director of International Strategic Alliances. The piece is titled Disintegration of Unipolar World Begins. In April, I was invited to speak about the US-China bilateral relationship. For the title of the speech, I chose Pushing China's Head Underwater Won't Make America Great Again. Recent developments suggest that an updated title would be Pushing China's Head Underwater Will Hasten America's Own Demise. There are two reasons for fine-tuning my title. First, the United States' deliberate tactics to obstruct China's growth and expansion have failed miserably while inflicting more hardship on Americans. The American people are paying a ghastly price for Washington's obsession with China. Second, priorities of America's foreign policy are not making any sense. The most recent example is the announcement by President Joe Biden that the United States will contribute $200 billion to the G7 pool of funds to compete with China's Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI. It's hard to tell where Biden is going to find that money. Even if all Group of Seven nations contribute their share of funds, it will be even harder to figure out to how they can implement the Belt Road Initiative-like projects in the developing world. Most probably, they would have to subcontract work to China, which knows how to implement it. On top of Biden's dream of grandeur, he's sending billions of dollars worth of arms and weapons to Ukraine to prolong the conflict with Russia. Bipartisan approval is easy when it comes to making war. By contrast, to relieve the inflationary pressure on America's domestic economy, Joe Biden is proposing to forgive 18 cents per gallon, or 4.76 cents per liter, of federal tax on gasoline for the three summer months. Wow, billions of dollars to compete with China and Russia and an 18-cent discount for the American motorist. In California, a gallon of gasoline has gone over $6, or $1.59 a litre. Saving 18 cents per gallon from a fill-up will barely cover the cost of a cup of coffee. In the United States, prices of everything has gone up. Inflation looms. Nay, inflation at 8.8% is already the highest in the past 40 years. Soon the American motorist won't even get a cup of coffee from his gas tax saving. Biden does not deny that Americans are facing inflation. He blames the inflation on Russian President Vladimir Putin and his special operation in Ukraine. He urges the American public to endure this for as long as it takes in order to defeat Putin. Hardly encouraging words. Of course, most American people are not aware that it has been the US-led North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, that baited Putin over the decades into the conflict with Ukraine. Washington has since congratulated itself for successfully mounting a proxy war, getting Ukrainians to fight the Russians. US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin even claimed that the war meets the objectives to wear down the strength of Russia, albeit at the expense of Ukrainian casualties and Ukrainian property. NATO celebrated a summit at the end of June where Sweden and Finland were formally included as new members. The organization accused China of not condemning Russia's special operations in Ukraine and therefore not standing with NATO. At its NATO summit, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea were invited as observers as a signal that NATO's expansion plans now include the North Pacific. Just to make sure nobody misses that intention, for the first time NATO identified China as a potential threat and a systematic challenge. So what constitutes China's threat to the security of NATO members? Apparently, it is the fact that China has dominated manufacturing of goods and prices that the West cannot compete with. China's gross domestic product, or GDP, continues to grow, and that makes NATO members nervous. West, led by the United States, has repeatedly accused China of violating rule-based international order. The most recent action by the Biden White House was to impose sanctions on goods made in Xinjiang province, alleging human rights abuses in China's Xinjiang province. In response, China, on the day after the conclusion of the NATO summit, announced the placement of an entire order for 292 commercial jetliners worth more than $37 billion with Airbus, the European consortium, and none to Boeing, the other major plane maker. This was a harsh, attention-getting message from China in response to President Biden's endless innuendos and baseless insults a signal that China is ready to play hardball with Washington. China's other message to the countries in the European Union, many of which are members of NATO, the Airbus order reaffirmed that China can be a major economic partner and poses no threat to the security of the European Union. Inflation in the European Union is rapidly getting out of control because of the war in Ukraine and the US imposed sanctions on Russia. If Joe Biden thought he was driving a stake into the heart of Russia's economy, he miscalculated. Vladimir Putin turned around and pegged Russia's energy exports to the ruble. Consequently, the value of the ruble against the euro has reached a 7-year high. The artificial shortage in world oil caused by the US sanctions on Russian oil has not hurt Russia. It makes money selling its oil to China, to India, and to other buyers at higher prices. However, major nations in the European Union, especially France, Germany and Italy, are energy importers and they are beginning to question the wisdom of following the US leadership. The world is beginning to see the difference between currencies based on assets and the American dollar, based on the full faith and credit of the US government. In other words, the Federal Reserve's printing press. Central banks of various countries are beginning to lighten their dollar holdings in favor of other reserve currencies, the most popular being China's renminbi. According to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the US dollar's share of the global currency reserves has fallen to its lowest point in more than two decades. To take advantage of the availability of Russian oil at favorable discount, India entered a rupee-for-ruble deal and get around paying in dollars. For the first time, India bought coal from Russia with the Chinese renminbi. While the G7 and then the NATO summit meeting took place in Europe, it was China's turn to host the BRICS meeting, which it did virtually. At the 2022 BRICS summit, Beijing invited many non-member countries as observers. Formed back in 2009, BRICS consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It is not a military alliance, but it's meant to promote collaboration for peace for security and global economic development. Compared with the G7, BRICS has three times the population, but only about 70% of the G7's gross domestic product, or GDP. At the 2022 BRICS summit, Argentina and the Islamic Republic of Iran formally applied to join BRICS. Adjusted for purchasing parity, the gross domestic product for BRICS Plus would surpass that of G7. And there is a proposal afoot to create a new global reserve currency based on the basket of BRICS Plus currencies as an alternative to the US dollar. Rather than going around the world collecting military allies and imposing sanctions on countries that do not wish to align with the United States, China invites partners to collaborate on mutually beneficial basis. Since it was initiated in 2013, China's Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, has launched more than 13,000 projects in 165 countries, valued at nearly $1 trillion. Most of the Belt and Road Initiative projects have to do with upgrading badly needed infrastructure, which leads directly to a boost in the recipient country's economy. There is now a high-speed rail link from China through Central Asia to Moscow, Russia, and onwards to Rotterdam on the Atlantic coast. 25 out of 31 Latin American countries are participants in the Belt and Road Initiative, as is most of Africa. At the just-concluded Group of 20 summit, the divide between the US-led Western bloc and China, Russia, and the non-aligned members of the G20 became quite clear. The summit concluded without the usual group photo of smiling state leaders and no joint declarations expressing optimistic steps for the future. Every year, China graduates 8 times as many students in STEM or science, technology, engineering, and mathematics than the United States. These human resources power developments in high technology for China. The more pressure the US exerts to stifle China's advance, the more determined the Chinese will be to find their own technical advances and skirt around American roadblocks.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is...